Well, hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. My guest for this episode is Jason Snell of The Incomparable, and we are going to be discussing The Diamond Age by Neal Stephenson, winner of the 1996 Hugo Award. So, Jason, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me. This is a great idea for a podcast, and I think you're in for some fun reading. I something like 15 years ago, I made a text file of every Hugo nominee and mark down the ones I'd read, and have very slowly and sporadically embarked on trying to cover them all, except I made the mistake of adding in other awards and stuff. But right. I think it's an admirable pursuit, because even though you can quibble with some of the decisions, it's a great opportunity to kind of walk through what people thought state-of-the-art science fiction was over the years. It's a fun journey. I read some really fun books by just trying to check boxes next to those titles in my text file that I still have.
Nice. Though with all the podcasting and reading for podcasts that you have to do, I have no idea how you get any extracurricular reading in. So,
well, what has killed my attempt to do that is that now instead, and I think this is still good, I every year I try to read all the nominees in a given category, Hugo or Nebula or both. And so, like, this year I read all the Hugo and Nebula novel nominees, which means going forward, basically I've read all the winners, which is great. But so it makes me more contemporary, but a little less historical with my collection. So be it.
Cool. Well, I definitely want to talk about The Incomparable a bit, but let's start talking about you a little bit. Kind of, what's your history? The history of your nerdery. Can you tell me about that?
Oh, the history of my nerdery goes back so far that it can't be measured. I grew up, like, as a kid, I loved space stuff. I loved Star Trek. I can't even remember not knowing and loving Star Trek. I watched it every night. I loved all the other. There was the Channel 2 in based in Oakland. We could get that clear even, you know, 100 miles away where I lived up in the foothills. And it had this amazing programming block where it had Star Trek at 5 o'clock generally. It usually had Batman on, and I loved that. And it had a show called Captain Cosmic, which was basically like an old-timey kid video show where there was an employee of the station dressed up in a costume. He was Captain Cosmic, and they had kind of a cardboard robot named 2T2. And they showed stuff, but it was basically an anthology. So they showed a bunch of Japanese stuff that had been dubbed into English that had been syndicated. They ran, so like, the Space Giants and Ultraman, and they showed, I think it was Captain Cosmic that showed Star Blazers, which is anime now, I know, but at the time it was just this weird space cartoon. And for all of that kind of stuff that they showed, plus Star Trek, plus Batman, it was like my fate was sealed at that point. So I don't know what Gilligan's Island, what effect that had on me. Let's hope nothing. And so, at a young age, I was a very early reader. I started reading when I was 2 years old. And so I was a voracious reader. By the time I was in elementary school, I had blown through, like, I blew through all the reading books at the school. By the time I was in fourth grade, I had read through all of the assigned readers. So they're like, start reading books in the library. The children's library in my town, the downstairs children's library, they had a science fiction shelf. I read every book on that shelf, some of them multiple times. And at some point, the children's librarian said, you should go upstairs to the adult library where there's more science fiction, because you've read all the kid and juvenile science fiction that there is. You should just go up there. And so, yeah, I was a voracious reader, loved sci-fi more than fantasy, because I love space stuff, because of Star Trek, I think. And so, yeah, so I was reading science fiction from a very early age, and then devouring science fiction novels at some point when I was a teenager, I think, or maybe a couple years before that. They launched, I think it was a launch, it may have been around a while, I don't know, the Science Fiction Book Club, which was like one of these things where they basically send you like a hardcover or two every month for a discounted price. It was like a, you know, it wasn't really a scam. It was one of those, if you don't want the book, you send it back. It was like a Time Life Books kind of thing.
Sure.
And my mom got that for me. And I that was my first real direct taste of current science fiction, because those were generally current books that were being sent out. Sometimes they were compilations or, you know, book club edition kind of things. And that, and at that point I was, we had two bookstores in my hometown. And you can imagine what happened. I did to them what I did to the library, which is go through the shelf, the science fiction shelf or shelves, and just like looking for things I'd heard about or things that looked interesting. And so, yeah, that, that whole story of my childhood all the way through high school was sort of voraciously reading. And a lot of that was, science fiction, including, I think one of the book club selections that I really got into was there was a Hugo, or it was a best, it was a best science fiction of the year.
Okay.
And that, and I think that's where I first learned about the Hugo Awards, because they, it was a short story anthology, but they mentioned all the novel winners too. And that, that's what sort of set me down the path to kind of be aware of the Hugos and interested in what the latest, you know, what was supposedly the best stuff that was out there.
Nice. Yeah, it's interesting hearing, I mean, some of the people that I've had so far on the show are very different than I was, because I was a kid who did not like to read. So that's kind of why I'm doing this podcast, is because I'm kind of trying to fill in for those years, the dark years when I like wouldn't read anything that wasn't a Star Trek tie-in novel. Because like you, I grew up watching original Trek in syndication. I think you're just a couple years older than I am. And, I'm from Anchorage, and it was a similar kind of thing where every night it was on. And they'd, I think they'd run through the whole thing, and then they'd go through all of Buck Rogers, which was fantastic. Yeah, so television was kind of my gateway into science fiction. And it's really only as an adult that I've gotten more into reading. So, so here we are. So, why don't we talk a bit about The Incomparable? How did you, well, or maybe a little more of your history. I know that you, you have a lot of history as a writer and editor.
Yeah. So I, spent more than a decade as a lead editor at, Macworld, and I write about computer stuff most of the time. And that's sort of what I view, write and talk. And I sort of view that as my professional life. And then I have this side thing where I've always been involved in more cultural projects as side projects. So I did a fiction, short fiction magazine called Intertext on the internet for about 10 years in the early days of the internet, when there were sort of no outlets for fiction on the internet, believe it or not. That was a time when the internet was small enough that there were, there could be literally not something, which it doesn't happen anymore. And then we did TV.org, which was one of the first television blogs, basically, before they were even called blogs. And then The Incomparable sort of ended up being the most recent of those side projects, which I've been doing about 7 years and is now a podcast network, which is talking about books and movies and TV and comics and all of that stuff.
Literally all that stuff. When you look at the full catalog now.
Too many things, too much stuff.
Yeah. So how did that come about, the podcasting part?
You know, a lot of my dabbling in pop culture stuff comes from trying out technology as part of my professional job. So like the TV website kind of came about because I have funny friends who were sending emails back and forth where they would write about television, and I thought this would be cool to put on the internet. And I was the only person who knew how the web worked, so I made that happen. And then I there was new software that made it, you know, more dynamic to build those websites and those pages. And so I tried that stuff out, and that was in the next generation of the TV website. And The Incomparable was a little bit like that, where we were really interested in podcast stuff at Macworld, and we started doing our own. And I thought that it, playing around in a new medium is something that's really fun when something's brand new and there are no rules. You can just get in there, and people who have technological leanings, more nerdy people, have an advantage when there's a new medium like that, because we're the ones who understand the tools, right? And so that was, and that, between that and a conversation about science fiction novels on Twitter in August of 2010, that is where The Incomparable came from. I was thinking about doing something to follow up TV, because the TV website had basically started to, had basically stopped at that point. It had faded away. And so it was sort of, time was ripe for a new side project. And I had friends on Twitter, like literally having long conversations about science fiction books they had read. And I thought, maybe this should be a podcast. Maybe that's the way to do this. And it really sprung from that.
Right. And now, you know, fast forward 7 years, and you have quite a catalog there. Do you want to talk a little bit about kind of the current state of The Incomparable?
Well, as a show, it's that you know 360 odd episodes at this point, which right. is just a matter of literally releasing an episode every week. The numbers do add up over time, mm-hmm.
right.
but there are a couple dozen podcasts on the network now. It is not a big business. It is a hobby kind of thing,
sure.
more than anything else. But what I've found is we built this system for The Incomparable. And there were some shows that I wanted to spin off where we had fun doing a game show and doing playing Dungeons and Dragons on the main podcast. But I felt like that was beyond the scope of the main podcast. So I wanted to create a place for them. And so all of a sudden we had this system that Greg Noss and I had built because we wanted to be able to do like an index of content. Cause you can go there and say like, show me everything they've talked about mm-hmm. in an alphabetical index. And we have that, which I think no other podcast CMS has, this thing that Greg built. And once it was built and I'd spun off a couple of things. Scott McNulty had been talking about doing a Star Trek podcast where he watches a random episode of Star Trek, which be 2 years after we first talked about it, we finally did it as mm-hmm. Random Trek, and that went on the network. And at that point, I started collecting podcasts and people because there were people in my orbit or in the orbit of people who were in my orbit, people who had ideas and they were interested in doing podcasts. And I said, well, I've got this thing already set up. If you just want to be part of the family, I can show you how to post. You know, I made a Google Doc with documentation and said, here, why don't you come? And then, you know, you turn around and there are 24 of them. And that's, it's great because I feel like they all have kind of, something in common in terms of having a take on popular culture of some sort or other.
Sure.
And that they're people I know, or they're people who, you know, who I know through somebody else, are kind of have become part of the family.
Cool. Yeah. It's when I first started getting into podcasts, The Incomparable was one that I found really early on. And I don't remember how I found it actually. It was probably actually just Googling a book that you guys had talked about, and like quickly became, okay, this is my favorite thing. It's going to the top of the list every time. and now there's so many podcasts on there, some of which, you know, are in orbits that I'm not really in. Like, I mentioned over email, like I've never watched Doctor Who. And so there's a lot of Doctor Who coverage, on The Incomparable.
There is, yeah. You can just skip right over that. Yeah. That's easy.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's the idea, is that I want people to talk about things that they love. So
right.
like, I personally am not into professional wrestling,
right?
But Mike Hurley loves it, and he wants to talk about it with his friends. And why not give that an outlet? That is not an appropriate show for his podcast network,
right.
I think. And it's perfect for The Incomparable, even though it's not something that I'm into. I don't watch a lot of reality TV anymore, but Maudie Ashley, who's been on The Incomparable for ages, mm-hmm. he and his girlfriend watch reality TV all the time, and they have a podcast about it now because they are excited about it. So it's not all to my taste either, but I feel like I can tell when somebody's enthusiastic about something cultural and they really want to talk about it. I like, that is the thing that pushes it over the edge for me. So
sure.
For me, that's sort of how I define it. And yeah, so it's a little kind of expanded haphazardly. It just kind of happens, but, it's been, I'm happy to have had that, the ability to say to people, like, if the only thing stopping you from doing a podcast is that you don't want to deal with all of the technical challenges of getting it up and running, I got this, you know, but
right.
just do it and we'll find a way to make it happen.
Cool. Well, I'll definitely put links in the show notes and link on Twitter and that kind of stuff, just because I absolutely want anybody who listens to me that doesn't already listen to The Incomparable, which I imagine is a pretty small number, I'd like to steer them your way because you guys do great work over there.
Thank you very much.
And especially, I think I'll drop a link in specifically to the Hugo and Nebula episode that just came out a few weeks ago.
Yes, we have a spirited discussion, sometimes more spirited than others about those. But yeah, we've been doing that. That's one of the fun things about this is you get that critical mass and then you start to do things with it. Like, we have basically made a pact, like we're going to read all the Hugo novels. Mm-hmm. I read them all.
It took, right.
Not when we recorded, but by the time it posted, I had read them all.
Okay.
But but it started with like the Hugo Awards, and we read the Hugo nominees and including the short stories.
Oh wow!
And it's just kind of morphed over time to be more like novel focused, but expand a little bit. But it's fun to have that group of people too. It's like a book club. We call it the Incomparable Book Club, but it's true. Right. It's like this is our way of saying we're going to read this book. Everybody read this book. And in Scott McNulty's case, he's already read it, but we're going to read this book and then we're going to talk about it, and it's a lot of fun.
Cool. All right, well, why don't we move on to talking a little bit about the book, just kind of in a non-spoiler way. Why this book?
Well, you know, you gave me a list, and there were some other ones I picked. I mean, you already talked to Lisa Schmeiser about Neuromancer, and it was right. One of those things where she loves the William Gibson stuff so much that even though I do too, I wanted to give that to her. This jumped out at me for a few reasons. One is I think Neal Stephenson is a really interesting novelist, and I think he's very, very good. I have liked most of the books that he's written a lot. And I think it's funny that this is his big award winner, given that he came to fame with Snow Crash, right? But Snow Crash didn't get nominated for anything. Whereas The Diamond Age got nominated for the Hugo Award and won. I think Snow Crash may have been nominated. It didn't win. This is his Hugo winner. Right. So that was kind of a way in. He has won some other science fiction novel awards over the ages. Baroque Cycle won a Locust Award. Anathem won a Locust Award. But Diamond Age is his Hugo novel. And so on one level, I wanted to talk about it because it's Neal Stephenson. I also wanted to talk about it because Stevenson's books are not perfect. He has some issues. He has issues with finishing. His third acts tend to be problematic. Snow Crash is an absolutely brilliant book, but by the end, it is nonsensical and bad.
Okay.
And I say that as somebody, I think overall, I think it's great, but it falls apart at the end. And you get the sense like the author himself does not know what to do with it. Diamond Age I think his next book, I think he published some books in between, but I'm not sure that he wrote books in between. There's a pseudonymous book called Interface that was published between Diamond Age and Snow Crash, but he had a co-author, and I'm not clear whether he actually wrote that between them or not. But It's his solo novel follow-up to Snow Crash, and it's better, like, in many ways. It is not as inventive in the ways that were flashy as Snow Crash, but, like, in terms of his craft, it's a better book. It's more ambitious, perhaps, in a different way, but I like it. And I think it gets missed. Even though it won the Hugo, I think it gets missed. And people talk, when they talk about Stevenson, they talk about Snow Crash, they talk about Cryptonomicon,
right?
They maybe talk about the Baroque Cycle, they definitely talk about Anathem, and you don't hear them talking about Diamond Age. And I think that's too bad, because I think it is a very good book that is in many ways a progression from Snow Crash.
I mean, from personal experience, this was actually the first of his books that I ever heard of, because I've been kind of out of it, right? Not really connected with contemporary science fiction all that much, unless somebody gives me a book, introduces me to an author, and then I kind of tend to do the thing where I read a lot of their work. But The Diamond Age was actually one that I had a colleague at work. He's like, "Hey, have you ever read The Diamond Age?" And he handed it to me. He highlighted passages for me, and I could never connect with it for some reason, until a couple of years later, I just randomly picked it up and really, really enjoyed it. And to this date, that's all of the Stevenson that I've actually read. And so I did want to pick your brain at some point a little bit about some of his other work. But you've already given me a little bit of an idea there. You're not really selling me on Snow Crash.
So Snow Crash is better. The first half of Snow Crash is maybe better than Neuromancer.
Okay.
And like I said, it falls apart, but okay. The beginning of it is really brilliant. And I'll say this: did you read Ready Player One?
Yes, I did.
Snow Crash is that, but better. I mean, it's they're very similar in some ways. And Snow Crash did it first, and it did it way better, but with fewer pop culture references.
Oh, fascinating! Yeah, because I look at Ready Player One, and I'm like, that book was a ton of fun, but I'm not sure how good it was. So
yeah, Yeah, so Snow Crash is a little bit different there, but it's got things to say about American culture and society and software and pizza and all sorts of things. And that's just the first chapter.
Okay.
And it goes from there. But yeah, he's gotten much better as a writer. He still writes too much. I mean, this is one of the things that the truth is that when he became a bigger name, he kind of got carte blanche to write 1,000-page right. novels, and nobody would stop him. And it probably reached its apex, arguably with a Baroque cycle, although I will defend the Baroque cycle. It's three novels, published as three books, each of which is more than 1,000 pages. So, and they all go together. If you look inside, it's a little bit like if you buy Lord of the Rings and you find there are three books inside that one
sure.
hardcover. The three Baroque cycle books contain eight books, basically. Mm. And I would kind of argue that dude wrote an eight book series, and I think it's pretty good. But yes, it's very, very long. And, you know, nobody really wants to read a 3,000-page novel, and yet I thought it was really great. And you could argue that NFM and especially ReamD and Seven Eves, his latest, are all probably, you know, 20% longer than they should be, 30% longer, that an editor should have come in and said, no, 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 no. And he seems to be beyond that now. And it's a problem. It's a problem in all of his work where I feel like he is so brimming with ideas and words just kind of spew out of him. And it's admirable, but sometimes he goes on these tangents and you're like, why? Why is this here? It's interesting. It would be interesting on its own. Why is it embedded in 30 pages of this novel that I don't care about? And that's Neal Stephenson. You just gotta kind of go with it because he's brilliant. It's like if you were at a dinner party or something with somebody who is a genius, and right. and they don't stop talking, and then an hour later you got to leave the party, and you're like, well, that he was a genius, but
right.
I didn't talk to anybody else. That's Neal Stephenson. That's the challenge with him.
Okay. Well, so about this novel in particular, if you had to give somebody an elevator pitch for what this book is about, how would you do that?
I would say, I mean, my pitch now might be different than in 1995, because there's some interesting ways that our world has changed in the last 20 years. I would say it's a neo-Victorian era, so it's the future, but it's been it feels a little bit like the past in some ways because the culture has changed,
right.
and there are dominant civilizations, including one that is very Victorian. This book is set on the kind of periphery of China. And technology is influencing culture in a couple of ways. Nanotechnology is remaking the world. And under all of this, a young girl receives a book that is the titled, because this book has a subtitle, it is A Young Lady's Illustrated Primer, or Primer, which is the correct way to describe that word, by the
right.
way.
Sure.
Primer is for paint, primer is for... Anyway, people yeah. give me a hard time about that.
Primer is a science fiction movie.
Nope.
No? Is that still Primer?
Primer is also Primer because it's meant for the same meaning. Anyway, the point is it's a young lady's illustrated Primer. She receives this young lady in poor circumstances receives a stolen book that is essentially an artificially intelligent super book designed to educate and uplift her and make her a free thinker. And on that hangs a tale of this future world. That's sort of how I would pitch it. Because at its core, this is about Nell,
right.
who is a lowest class person off the shores of Shanghai. And she gets this book that is meant for an upper class girl. And the book is essentially magical. It definitely is a reference yeah. to fantasy in the feel of it, but it's technological, but what it does would seem magical to any of us. It is an artificially intelligent storytelling device that that is teaching her what she needs to know to grow and become a very, you know, particular kind of special person.
Yeah. What do you think the genre, I mean, it's science fiction, obviously, and it has sort of bits of cyberpunk in it, but it has that Victorian thing, and there's airships made of diamond, of course.
Yes, because it's the Diamond Age. The idea there is like, you know, you had the Bronze Age and the Silver Age and all that, and the Diamond Age is when nanotech can reassemble carbon into diamonds, so diamond right. is just everywhere.
Yeah,
that's,
super
that's
cheap.
That's the idea here.
Yeah, so vacuum-filled diamond airships. And with the Victorians, it feels kind of steampunky as well.
Yeah, today I think we might call it something like future steampunk, with a wink.
Sure.
Because it is science fiction, absolutely. But in tone, it is trying to seem retro, both in the novel's construction, where it's got the little sections that say, like, this is the part where this happens, and then you right. get that part, which is a very kind of old-fashioned novel device, and in right. the fact that there is this neo-Victorian faction that's going on here. I would say it I don't know when steampunk really kind of emerged, but it kind of prefigures steampunk in that way. But it's definitely set in the future. So right. it's a steampunky science fiction, basically.
Yeah, it's really, to me, it's very interesting and kind of going into overall thoughts about the book. And mm-hmm. there's an old episode of the Sci-Fi Vortex with Harlan Ellison on it. And they're talking about what is science fiction versus sci-fi. And he talks about science fiction kind of talking about implications of technology and examining the human condition. And by that standard, this book, you know, succeeds beyond all expectations, just because it takes the idea of nanotechnology kind of post-scarcity and what does society look like in response to that. And then it really even weaves in another possible conflict in the move from the feed to the seed, which is something I feel like I need to read this book 3 or 4 more times to really get that part. But yeah, it basically, he goes, well, what could we use nanotechnology for? And then just spews out every possible use he could think of mm-hmm. in the book. And to me, it's a huge credit that the book holds together at all, given the number of kind of things that he tries to do with it.
Well, welcome to the world of Neal Stephenson, because I think this, more than anything else, this describes, I think, what makes Stephenson's novels stand apart is the just sheer inventiveness of the man's mind, where he, and again, are the characters in Neal Stephenson's books memorable? No, not really. Some of the most memorable Neal Stephenson characters for me are generally historical figures in the Baroque cycle, who were very interesting characters, but are largely historical figures that he's just put in his fictional narrative. There are some, but there are not that many. But his ideas and his, in that true science fiction way of sort of extrapolating, like, okay, nanotechnology is a thing. In the mid-90s, there was a lot of talk about how this was going to be a big future direction. It has not as so much technology. It has not advanced as quickly as perhaps those who predicted it would have predicted. But
sure.
the idea that once you can order things on an atomic scale, on a molecular scale, that technology gets really different and kind of weird. And so he throws that and AI and some other things in a hat and populates his world with it. And then it's just all about like all the ramifications of this, like yeah. list them off. And that's I think that is what makes him brilliant, is that you feel like you're one of the reasons I think a lot of people read science fiction, one of the reasons I read science fiction, is that I want to imagine how our world could be in the future, very, very different when it is today. As much as I love Star Trek, like, and a lot of traditional science fiction, they'll say 200 years in the future, and it's basically us, and the technology is basically not that different. They've got faster computers.
Yeah.
And you know, and the society is very much like ours, and they use that to comment on our society, but somebody like Neal Stephenson, it's like he's saying, no, 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 things in the future are going to be really different in so many different ways. Our societies will be different. He's, again, pretty smart for 20 years ago. He is a lot of modern science fiction does this today, predicting kind of the fall of nation states as being irrelevant sure. and right. the rise of different corporations. Or in this case, he's got these different kind of like amalgamations of culture that have replaced the nation state. And then all his nanotech stuff is thrown in there too. And it really does give you a feel of like, this is our world, but it's also very alien because of technology driving cultural change, which inevitably will happen. It's just a matter of what will the technology be and what change will it drive. And with Stephenson, you get a little window in this book into this very particular world where the nanotech stuff has really changed how society functions.
Yeah. As I was reading through it, I was taking notes on my tablet just on all the uses for nanotechnology. And I thought, I'm going to write all of them down. And then I got like 20 of them down and okay, I'm not writing any more down. It's kind of everything. It's pretty amazing the fact that a coherent story comes out of this at all. And the funny thing is that one of the kind of the last things to even come into it is the idea of computing, what nanotechnology can do for computing. And that kind of gets into the drummers and distributed AI and that kind of thing. But just
right, which is in many ways a more traditional kind of science fiction part. Right. Like the nanotech is a little more radical. The AI stuff is a little more traditional, and sure. it's kind of a plot. You know, like Gibson, the plot is there to take you around and have some adventure and show this world to you. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily the point. It needs to be there, but right. Is it anything special? Yeah. No, it's just a plot. It's fun. I think it's interesting. There's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of stuff that goes on back and forth and the conspiracy and people, you know, suborned by other people because of their, you know, receiving stolen property and other things like that. But in right. The end, yeah, it's like Gibson's plots. It's not particularly advanced in a narrative form. It's just there to drive you around and show you the sights.
Yeah. Well, if you had to recommend this book, people who are interested in other media, other kinds of books, you know, what? Who would you recommend it to?
Well, I think people who love what we just described, which is science fiction that takes you to a future world, our world in the future, and is extrapolating like future technology. People who are really excited. I think Stevenson in general is really great for people who are interested in two things, which is one, how future tech is going to grow, and what that might mean in terms of what it can do, and two, how future tech influences future cultural shifts and challenging your predisposition to believe that everything is going to stay the same. So I think it is Stevenson. I don't know if he gets called a hard sci-fi writer, but in some ways I think he is kind of like a hard culture sci-fi writer where it's like a little mixture of the two. But if you've listened to this description of like, the fact that it deals with like nanotech and artificial intelligence, and it's in this kind of weird Victorian context, and yet it's in the future. Like, I think you know whether you're interested in this, but I think it's a good. I also think it's Stevenson before he got too out of control with himself. Like, I love some of his later books, but this is a little more buttoned down for him in terms of it's not 1400 pages long, and right. that is a good thing. You will find, and this is something we haven't talked about, but the primer itself, the book that Nell gets in this book, is funny. Like, it seems less, you mentioned your iPad, like it yeah. seems less futuristic now than it did in 1995.
Yes.
In fact, one of the girls in this book who gets one of these primers is named Fiona. And your trivia of the episode is that was the code name for the Kindle.
Oh, fascinating.
And taken from Stevenson, taken from this book. And in fact, there are still places that you go on Amazon's site where you're doing Kindle settings, where if you look in the URL, it'll actually say /Fiona, because Fiona was the name of the Kindle project. And it's all because of the Young Ladies Illustrated Primer. It is that when they were working, that was one of their inspirations. And it's funny because today we read this book and it's like, I got Kindles, we got iPads, like a tablet that you connects you to the world, and like young children holding one of those things and opening, you know, and having it entertain them and tell them stories and all that. It's like, that's already happening. And right. So that's really interesting that is the one place where, you know, our perspective in 2017 is very different from our perspective in 1995 or 1996.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, we'll talk about the idea. You and I grew up I grew up in the 70s and 80s, and I think you're just a little before I am. And so, you know, the idea of having anything like that, like an iPad that could entertain you on a road trip or on a plane flight. You know, I always tell my son when he complains about this kind of stuff, he's 15, and I'll be like, you know, we did a road trip from Oregon to Wisconsin when I was like 9 years old, and I had a magnetic chess set. and a book of crossword puzzles. And that was it. So, yep. So just deal.
Yeah.
So is it a net positive or negative for society? I don't know.
You know, people talk about jetpacks and flying cars and stuff like that. And like, where I was promised these things. Like, dude, we have a supercomputer screen that's the size of a book that you can take with you anywhere and be connected to a worldwide computer network. And it's color and high definition and plays games and does music and plays movies. And I mean, like the iPad and smartphone, but let's just say like the iPad and the Kindle, like these are science fiction. These are like the iPad is science fiction from 20 years ago in 1995 when Neal Stephenson did this. The iPad was science fiction. Like that is one of those cases where like, okay, yeah, no jetpacks. Turned out that was kind of implausible. Mm-hmm. We have no AIs that are plumbing the secrets of the universe and trying to kill us. We don't have that. But what we do have is these things, which are completely in the vision of science fiction of the 70s, 80s, and even 90s. So that's it's hard not to look at Diamond Age now and be like, all right, like got that one. That was that's like, it's not like we have like a it's an AI that tells stories. There's an amazing little bit where the girl where Nell is asking questions of the storyteller.
Right.
And there's like, it's an AI, but there's also an actress. It's kind of complicated, but there's an amazing little moment there where she's telling a story and then the girl asks a question. And like, if you, as a parent, right, it's like, oh boy, like, but why is this? And the sequence is incredible because there's always an answer. So like the story gets into the parentheticals of like, oh, well, why did her father do that? And it's like, well, let me tell you that story. And it's like, oh, and within that story, it's like, oh, why did this happen? It's like, oh, well, that's because this happened and this happened. And you get the sense like this AI, Stevenson's showing you like what AI really could mean, which is bottomless intelligence, bottomless storytelling, where like everything in that story, there's an answer that can be generated. And so that girl can just sit there and it's like hypertext, except it's storytelling. She can just dive as deep down into the world of that story as possible and she'll never find the bottom. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's a great little moment. And we don't have that yet, but still, you know, this idea of kids with tablets that educate them and open them to the world. Like we've got that. 20 years later, we have it.
Yeah. Well, I think we've kind of danced around major spoilers at this point, but I think it's time to go into spoiler talk. So anybody listening, if you haven't read this book, it's not a tiny little book, 500 pages-ish.
It's tiny for Neal Stephenson. What are you talking about?
Yeah. So if you've read any other Stephenson, you're probably well prepared.
It's a novella. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I definitely recommend picking this one up, and it sounds like it's a strong recommendation from Jason as well. So
I think so. I would, if somebody was looking to start with Stevenson, I think it's either this or actually Zodiac, which is not science fiction at all, which is one of his first novels, which doesn't get a lot of play. But those of us who know it and have read it generally think it's huge fun, but it's not really science fiction. So Diamond Age for sci-fi for Neal Stephenson, this is where I would say to start. And if you love this, then you got thousands and thousands of pages waiting for you in other novels.
Yeah. Well, so in terms of spoilers, we can just, Jason, we can jump off to any place, anything you want to talk about, highlights, lowlights, themes, whatever.
I read this so long ago, and my admission is that I didn't get to reread the whole thing, although now I actually want to. I read enough of it that I was like, God, I'm going to have to read this whole thing again. So, you know, it is, I would say, I'm not even sure I can spoil this, because like you alluded to earlier, like the feed, some of it is like unclear about exactly what's going on, and I don't know how much of that is the obfuscation of the author and how much of it is the author kind of like intentionally obfuscating you because he doesn't know the answer. And he does have a problem with endings. I mean, I think that this book is not particularly satisfying at the end. It's the journey that is the reward more than the end.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, so it's one of those kind of books where I'm not sure there's much to be spoiled about it. It's really, I mean, right? Because it's just about reading and being in the world more than anything else. I don't know how you thought about the end, but for me, it's just like, yeah, it's okay. You know, it was a great ride.
Yeah, I think I was hoping for a little more of a catharsis at the end when Nell finally finds Miranda. But I don't know. It doesn't totally bother me. I there's still stuff about, like I said, the feed and the seed that I'm not sure that I've completely picked up on. And some of the, just kind of the geopolitics toward the end, where, you know, what has become of Atlantis Shanghai? Is it still okay? Cause the Celestial Kingdom has kind of won the land war there. So
yeah, the feed and the seed is interesting too. Cause I mean, the argument there is that it's kind of like Stevenson is saying, the feed is, I don't know, capitalism, and the seed is like makers.
Yeah.
It's kind of, I don't know, is that really what the book is about? I guess on a very broad scale it is, because he's got like the Victorians who are really top down and annoying, not even though I like that. I always like it when an author makes the people who we're supposed to identify with not the best people, like, yeah. Oh yeah, this is where English speaking culture went, is to these guys, the Victorians, so you're on their side, right? No. And then the seed, yeah, is very much like the drummers and all that, and the idea of like that it's like maker tech, and anybody can do it, and it's bottom-up technology, and that and in something as dangerous potentially as nanotechnology, but also as powerful and has so much potential, that's an interesting argument of like, do the people in power use this to control everything and keep it under lock and key? Or do you just kind of throw it open and let 1,000 flowers bloom? And potentially gray goo the entire planet, I guess.
Yeah, and that's where, when you look at the nature of the feed, right? The prosperous people have a large feed, and like the Thetes and the least territories, they have a little feed and a little matter compiler. And it, to me, it kind of reminds me of the current debate over net neutrality, where just, you know, whoever controls the size of that feed and where it comes from, they're really in charge. And so the seed to me is just kind of that taken away from them and given to everybody.
Right. It's the idea is also like, it's a means of control, like limiting resources is a means of control. And he's making, I think, an economic argument about economic systems that are designed to keep populations in control by limiting their means.
Right.
And how technology might break that, and what would that mean for those societies? I think that's a really interesting question that doesn't get too far into it here, but it's definitely part of what's going on. And I also like that this, you could view this as being kind of an answer to, like, how do you build a, like Star Trek, like utopia, where everybody can build anything and nobody has any money and you can just do anything and the replicator will build everything for you.
Right.
And here what he's saying is, well, like we can build anything, but access to the materials to build anything is rationed. And that's why it's not a utopia, because, you know, that would be a really boring book if it was a utopia.
Sure.
So here, like some of the Star Trek episodes where it's portrayed that way, it's like, well, that sounds really boring. Let's not tell stories in that universe. And so Stevenson has that, like, it comes back to the rationing. Like, what happens where you've got this amazing technology that can do anything, but only some people can use it?
Right. And they have, you know, the public matter compilers, right? So people on the street aren't starving, but they're not doing well either. And I think it's fascinating that it's kind of simultaneously, the book is kind of presenting a post-scarcity society, but then also explicitly saying, look, in the inland China is not doing well right now, and they're going back to exposing infants. How does that happen in a post-scarcity society? And I don't know.
Well, it's it reminds me of the concept of basic income, which is dwelt upon a little bit in The Expanse novels. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've read those.
Just the first one.
So it was nominated for a Hugo Award, I think. So yeah, it so Earth in those, and obviously those novels are largely set in space, but Earth, it is revealed over the course of those novels. No spoilers here. It's just world building stuff that they do in the background. But it is essentially a post-scarcity society in a way, but it's a basic income society. Mm. And the idea, and people have talked about this for our world, about a possible future where when you've got automation taking away jobs, like how do you deal with the cultural ramifications? And basic income, the idea there is you give everybody a certain amount of money to live. Right. And they don't, just for being alive. Mm-hmm. They get that money. And it is enough to buy, like, people on basic income in The Expanse can go to a replicator, essentially, and they can get clothes, and they can get food. The clothes are generic, and the food is generic, and it's healthy, but it's not pleasant. Mm-hmm. And the idea is, If you want more, you have to work. You have to do more. But everybody is going to get a basic level of care. But it's not great, because if it was great, then who would work? That's the argument. And it's a little bit, it reminds me of this here a little bit, which is, you know, the poor people can get stuff, but only at this basic level. And it's like, it's enough to keep them alive. But in Stevenson's world, it's enough to keep them under control, that right, they're not going to rise up because they are, you know, they have limited access to the riches of this world, and the poor people are still poor, even if they're better off than they were.
Yeah. So one other thing I wanted to talk about was just, I mentioned that a coworker had lent me the book, and I started reading it, and it's not really a tone shift so much, it's just, it almost shifts genres after the opening bit of it that follows Bud, who is a very kind of cyberpunk character, where he's getting fitted for a new skull gun, you know,
and
and he's driving, he's skating around the leased territories on rollerblades, really fast ones.
It's the '90s.
It is the '90s. I remember it well, but yeah, just his story. I kind of started reading it and I'm like, okay, here's our protagonist. And, you know, we're in spoiler section, and 15, 20 pages later, he is dead. And it's just, it's fascinating the way Stevenson did that. And essentially what he did was he wanted to show how nanotechnology could be used in criminology, and also to talk about the Confucian justice system, which I thought was fascinating, with Judge Fang.
Yeah, it's your classic fake out. I think he's also like giving people what they're expecting from him after Snow Crash, and
okay,
given the cyberpunk movement as well. Like, I think that's one of his, like, that's a fake out, where he wants you to think that this book is one thing and it's totally not.
Mm-hmm. I really thought that the Victorians were an interesting kind of group of people to follow. And like you said, they're kind of presented as these are point of view people, you know, the English speaking people, and yet they're not necessarily wonderful. And just the notion where the primer first comes up between Finkel McGraw and Hackworth, and the idea of when you have this perfect society, do you then have people who grow up and become high achievers? Because Hackworth was someone who didn't come from privilege. And so Finkel McGraw is concerned that, well, my granddaughter has come from privilege and I want her to have an education that somehow gives her that life experience that Hackworth had, that kind of turned him into that engineer that he became. Ultimately, I don't see that the primer really accomplished that goal. When you look at where his granddaughter ended up and where Fiona ended up. So what do you think about that?
I don't know. It's hard for me not to think that ultimately it is, you know, it's a construct to tell the story Stevenson wants to tell, not to pull it out of the plot, but
okay.
I think that's part of what's going on here, is that really it's like a MacGuffin basically, little bit, where it's like he wants a plot device to get this thing into the hands of Nell so that she can have this experience, because that's the interesting thing, is what if expensive tech, you know, for rich people gets in the hands of a poor person and they get to take advantage of that education. I think that's just, everything's engineered around getting to that point. And the rest of it is sort of like, you know, shrug a little bit. I don't know. I've never thought of it from the perspective that you've described, though. But that's just, for me, that was always just, you know, a reason to get it in Nell's hands, because that's why that happens.
Sure. Though there's another example also of the primer maybe not having the intended consequence, and that's where Dr. X wants the primers for all the orphans, the Chinese orphans, where they end up becoming Mouse Army and becoming loyal to Nell. And I thought that was, I'm not sure that's what he intended either.
Right.
And so you have these two characters who have a real intention for what this can do for their society, and it doesn't necessarily do that.
So Stevenson's an interesting guy, and he is, I don't even want to try to describe him politically, but I would say that he's a free thinker and a little bit of a, you know, he's kind of a libertarian, and without getting into, like, I don't actually know his politics, but he's always struck me as being kind of iconoclastic and idiosyncratic, and like he's his own guy, and he's got it really interesting, and he will question you and challenge you. And so I think it is fair to say that perhaps what he's saying here is a book or, you know, a program, whatever this thing is, a system of thought that is designed to train people into being free thinkers, rebels, and creative people is not going to give you something that you expect, and they're not going to be under your control, right? And I think that in the end, that's what he's saying about this primer, is like, if you're giving this to somebody expecting an outcome, a specific outcome, and that specific outcome isn't going to be that their mind's going to be opened and they're going to do what they damn well please, regardless of what you want, then you're going to be disappointed, because that's what's going to happen. Like, they're going to be their own people. They're going to make their own decisions. You don't get to control them anymore. They're going to do what they want. And that this is like an object that unlocks free thought, I think, is and understanding, having read a lot of Stevenson, that doesn't surprise me that he would think, and let's take it back a level, that book, it's a book, that books do this is also, I think, what he's saying is reading is opening your mind. And once you open your mind, people who are under control or who are in all sorts of different situations will be changed, and their minds will be opened, and they will think more broadly. And somebody who has been educated in this way is going to break free of what they're expected to do and make their own decisions. I mean, if I was writing a paper about Diamond Age, I think I would that would be one of my theses for sure, is that this is about the transformative property of books. I like, right? Because science fiction... Part of science fiction is what we talked about, which is sort of looking at science today and saying, how's it going to be in the future and how will it impact our society? But part of science fiction is telling stories about the time that the author writes the story and what they believe about the world as it stands at that moment. And I think that's clearly part of what Stevenson is doing here, is saying, hey, books really open your mind, give people access to books and they will be better people.
Sure. Well, and it's almost explicit, actually, now that you talk about that, about opening your mind. There's a passage that talks about, let's see, I actually wrote it on here. Now, nanotechnology had made nearly anything possible, and so the cultural role in deciding what should be done with it had become far more important. And so it talks about kind of how anybody can read any newspaper, because paper is interactive now. And so you don't have to go buy the New York Times, you can just tap that up in whatever paper that you have. But it kind of mentions that in the Victorian revival, they saw that it's not necessarily desirable to have everybody reading different things. And so the higher up you go in the Victorian society, the more similar your paper becomes. And that that really is that kind of conformity and echo chamber thing that we see happening even now.
Right. That's the means of control by limiting information. Yeah, and this is a Victorian dystopia, essentially. They've remade the Victorians. There's a moment where they criticize late 20th century society and say they were hypocrites because they thought, you know, they thought that being a hypocrite meant this and meant believing one thing while doing the other, or saying one thing while doing the other. But in fact, we know that that's just fine, that, you know, we have our standards and we don't live up to them, but that's okay because we're only human. And it's a funny moment of like, oh, okay, like they are... This is a kind of an unpleasant society that we shouldn't be rooting for, but that this is their dystopia, is they're going to control information and they're going to limit resources to the poor people, and this is the means of control that they use to hang on to their society and make it what they want it to be.
Yeah. Talking of funny moments, there's some very funny passages in this that just have me howling every time I've read it. At some point, Hackworth, I think, is having lunch with Judge Fang, and he puts sauce on his sandwich, and then he sits there thinking about the ingredients in the sandwich, or in the sauce, including axle grease and nuclear shavings or something.
That's right. He puts like brown sauce, which having been, you know, in England, and they've got this brown sauce, and it's like, well, that is, as an American, it's like brown sauce, and they're like, right. Yeah. You know, like, what's in it? And it's funny because it starts out as reasonable ingredients and gets increasingly terrifying as it goes. It's very funny. No, Stevenson's, he's a funny writer. He does that. Sometimes I wish he would do that more, because sometimes it goes on a long time and there'd be, I kind of want to ask for more amusement, but at the same time, I feel like the same thing that makes him throw in all these jokes is the same impulse that makes him go on all of these digressions.
Sure.
That are, again, I don't want to beat him up for him, because I think his digressions are actually really good, mm-hmm. but they are digressions. And when you're in a 1,000-page book, you realize, oh, like it's like having a book that is half footnotes. And it's like, this is not what I really signed up for. And you keep kind of diverting me from where I think I'm going. But I think it's the same impulse. But he is a funny guy. He has very funny observations. It's not dry, for sure.
Yeah, definitely. Any other things that you want to talk about in the book?
I don't think so, other than to say that I enjoyed revisiting it in the parts that I did, and I actually do want to go back and reread it, which, you know, with most Stevenson books is a challenge because they are very long. But I really did like this book, and I remember, I mean, it also took me back just reading that the paperback again to the 90s. Like, I remember reading this book on BART when I lived in the East Bay and worked in San Francisco, and I distinctly remember reading this book sitting on a train going out to the East Bay from BART after working, and that plate, you know, I only lived in the East Bay and worked in downtown San Francisco for a couple of years, like, you know, 96, 97. Mm-hmm. So it is just holding the paperback in my hand and thinking about this book took me back to probably, you know, 1996, and being a, you know, junior editor at MacUser or Macworld at the time, one of those, probably MacUser, and riding the train from place to place. Cause so it definitely took me back 20 years when I was reading it and thinking about it.
Yeah. I usually like to look at the competition for the Hugo, and it's funny, so many times so far, I'll look at the competition and go, I don't know any of those other titles. And so it kind of says that they picked the right winner, but also that just could be that I know them because they're the Hugo winner.
Well, I chuckled at this list because there's one book on here that I've read, maybe two, I'm not sure. I think only one. But it is a bunch of familiar authors who get nominated for Hugos a lot, especially Connie Willis, mm-hmm. who was nominated for Remake, which I think I didn't read, but I think I remember seeing the book cover all the time in the bookstore, because it's this idea of like computer movies have brought all the old movie stars back to life in the computer, and you just change them and they'll digitize things and all that, which I think might be interesting to read now because that is technology that is rapidly becoming more and more true. So that I remember that book cover, but Connie Willis has been nominated for a million Hugo Awards and has
won
many of them as well.
She's got at least two wins, right? To say nothing of the dog, Doomsday Book.
Yeah, exactly. Well, no, and she won for Blackout and All Clear as well in 2010, 12, something like that. So she's won a lot. And Hugo, you know, she's no Lois McMaster Bujold, but she is definitely a somebody who the Hugo voting community loves. Robert J. Sawyer, who's also been nominated a lot and I think has won. His book, The Terminal Experiment, was nominated this year. I haven't read that one. I've read Sawyer. I haven't read that one. But that's a book about somebody who puts his personality in a computer and runs three different simulations. And it's sort of a, you know, what different paths could my life have taken. But I haven't read that one either. And I think I've heard of it. The Time Ships by Stephen Baxter, I've definitely heard of, because it's basically like a sequel to H.G. Wells's The Time Machine. But I haven't read it. And the book I've read is Brightness Reef by David Brin, which is basically his original Uplift trilogy became wildly popular to the point where Brin was like, all right, and went back and did more Uplift books. And this was the first of the new Uplift books. So it was quite a big deal, like heavily marketed. People talked about it because everybody loved Star Tide Rising, especially, and Uplift War too. But Star Tide Rising, they both won the Hugo Award, right? Mm-hmm. So people were really excited about these, and they're not bad. That second trilogy is not bad, but it's not as good as Uplift War and Star Tide Rising.
Yeah, I think the Time Ships is the only one on here that I knew the name of. Although I know that I did know the author names, but
yeah, the I think it's kind of impressive. But like I said, Neal Stephenson's coming off of Snow Crash here, so
right.
Even though I would say it's kind of impressive that this one, given that there's the new Uplift book and Connie Willis, who everybody always loves, and Robert J. Sawyer has generally been liked. I don't know if that he was a favorite of the Hugos at the time, or if that this was sort of the start of that. But you know, Neal Stephenson, I will say, probably some of the support he gets for this book is from the recognition, the recognizance of Snow Crash. Like, people are like, that got him on the map, and so they took this book seriously, and then they liked it and they voted for it for the Hugo. But it does owe at least some of its appeal and its votes probably to the existence of Snow Crash. But you know, the that's what these awards are like, is like, this may be a lesser Connie Willis, in fact, I don't know, but because it's Connie Willis, perhaps it got nominated. That happens sometimes.
Okay, well, final thoughts, Jason.
Neal Stephenson is a really fun author. And this is a book that for a while I have recommended to people who are interested in Neal Stephenson. He's got other books that I really love. Cryptonomicon is great. It's also more than 1,000 pages. The Baroque Cycle is great. It's more than 3,000 pages. And Anathem is actually, if you're somebody who likes science fiction novels that when you start reading them, you have no idea what's going on, and in the act of reading them, it kind of rewires your brain and teaches you what you need to know. Anathem is, I think, one of the best examples of that kind of book, where when you start it, you're like, I have no idea what is happening here or what these words mean. And by the end, you totally get it. And it's really interesting and very weird. Again, a very long book, but definitely a science fiction novel with a lot of interesting concepts. And Seven Eves recently is very much a science fiction novel and kind of a widescreen story over long time periods about a disaster that befalls the Earth and the people who are kind of left alive in space, who are trying to keep the human race alive. And it's not my favorite of his, but it is I think it's good. It's just not, I think it's too long, actually. It's one of my, it's like three books kind of stuck together. And then his book Reamdi is, I actually think, kind of a fun thriller, but it's much more of an action movie than it is a science fiction book. The last half of it is basically like people running around blowing things up and shooting guns. So it's kind of a departure from him.
But
I have never read a Neal Stephenson book that I've said, I wish I hadn't read it. So that's what I would say about him. And if you read The Diamond Age and you liked it, I would say either try Snow Crash or Zodiac, or maybe dive into Cryptonomicon, which is a very good book about an adventure involving cryptography.
Nice. I actually own that one, and I opened it on my Nook and went, okay, this is going to be an undertaking, and I'm not sure I'm up for it right now. So
it's 900 pages. Yeah, it's good, but it's very long.
Okay, cool. Well, Jason, I really want to thank you for doing this. I know that you're super, super busy, and the fact that you took the time to do this, I can't thank you enough.
And I'm happy to be here. Thank you for getting me to think about one of my favorites again and revisit Neal Stephenson a little bit, because it's been a lot of fun.
Okay, well, I think that'll do it for us. So again, thanks, Jason. And maybe down the line you can pick one that you actually haven't read yet. I actually forgot to ask you how many of the winners you've read. I don't know if you have that tally at hand.
40. I actually need to update my file. It's not updated, but I've read them all recently. So I'd say 40 Hugo novels that I've read. Basically most of them since 1969. But I've got some misses in there.
That's a lot more than I've read. I am at 16 now. Although I started at 12. I think half of these have been rereads for me. But at some point, if you want to fill in some of the ones from, you know, the 50s and 60s, just let me know, because I think those ones are going to be less likely to get somebody volunteering for them.
You'll get somebody for Man in the High Castle and Stranger in a Strange Land and Canticle for Leibowitz and Starship Troopers. I mean, those are kind of, and Fahrenheit 451 and The Demolished Man, and The Mule is basically just Foundation. Mule is just part of Foundation. Actually, it's like it's one of the, or maybe the sequel But okay. it's actually inside of, it's one of the parts of Foundation's, I forget, the second one.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, sure. And there are other ones that I would probably love to revisit too. I mean, I got a lot on the list. I've also got a few that I tried and failed to read that maybe I'll try again sometime. But like Snow Queen by Joan Vinge and Down Below Station by C.J. Cherry. I bought both of those as a part of this project to read all the Hugo novels. And I started reading and I was like, oh no, I can't. They were both just like, I just couldn't. I feel bad, but like both of my abandoned. I was just like, I can't. I have a little minus next to them in my little document. Instead of a star, I've got a minus. It's like, you failed.
It's funny. Most of the names that you rattled off from the 50s and 60s are ones I've already done that I've already read. So, those are the ones that I think are more likely for people who have already read. Yeah, at some point I'll have to buckle down and just ask people to do a particular one. But I wanted to do this. I pitched this when I emailed Scott McNulty. I said, I'm basically doing random Hugo. It's just instead of being random, I'm just letting the guest choose it. So
no, I think it's a really great idea. I like how it's it is similar to Sophomore Lit in the sense, for me at least, because I'm reading these older books, but there's recent books too that you know people might be interested in talking about, and that's cool. Like if somebody wants to talk about the Graveyard Book or Wind Up Girl or Spin, there are a lot of recent, last 15 years choices that are great. American Gods, Harry Potter. I mean, there's a bunch in there. So you got a lot to choose from, and most of them are actually pretty good. So that's nice.
I really appreciate you doing this one.
Sure.
So I'll let you go. All right.
Okay.
Thanks, Jason. Bye.
Bye.
Well, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Jason. And of course, I cannot recommend highly enough that you check out The Incomparable. It's the flagship podcast itself is fantastic. And the network is just chock full of interesting podcasts that you can check out. So I'll put links to all that in the show notes. Like I said, I will put a link to the episode in which they discussed the Hugo and Nebula nominees for this year. For my next episode, I will be talking to Carrie Lynn Evans, and we are going to be talking about The Three Body Problem, which is a pretty recent winner. So that's the homework for next time. In the meantime, I want to encourage you to check out our social media, which is all Hugo's Podcast. So at Hugo's Podcast on Twitter, facebook.com/Hugo's Podcast. And, give us a like there. And if you wouldn't mind going and giving us a rating or a review or both in iTunes or Stitcher or TuneIn Radio or Google Play, that would be fantastic. I'd really appreciate it. So I think that'll do it for this time, and I will talk to you next month.